Mr. Duncan Reel too?
Yes, straight down on the gun that night into action. In fact, there were men actually on the gun who had been called up. Most of them were Londoners. They'd been called up, reported at Cosham, the HQ of this battery. And that day, detached to the different batteries around Portsmouth and went into action with no training whatsoever. They had overalls and their civilian respirators, where they hadn't had time to be kitted out even. and they proved excellent gunners. One who I know in particular finished up a sergeant in the troop.
How effective were the 4.5s against the German aircraft?
Very effective at visual targets, of course. In fact, when they were stationed at Southsea Common, from the first daylight raids on Pompey, they'd engaged at maximum range and brought the lead plane down. And this is something like 7 miles away, the lead plane. They're very accurate, providing you had a visual target. And the predictor teams had actually, the regiment had won the King's Cup in about 1935, which was open to all TA units in the country. So they were a very experienced unit indeed. But at night firing, obviously it was mostly barrage, pre-arranged barrage, and they did have a Vic-L sound location system, like big earphones, but it was very crude. That was before radar. And most of our work at night was barrage work.
What were these Vic-L systems like?
Very crude. They'd only give a rough bearing and angle so that the predicting instruments could be put on that bearing and angle to produce information, to give you a fuse of what to set the shell to burst at what height. But as I say, it's very crude. Indeed, really. In fact, these were manned by Marines, the Vic-L that we had on our site.
How do you spell Vic-L?
VL.
What does VL stand for?
I don't know what the V... It's location, obviously, you know. And one would think visual location, but it isn't, is it?
It should be sound.
As radar came in to be.
How far away from the battery were the locators?
They were actually on the same gun site, a matter of about 50 yards away from the guns, actually, this mounting that they had.
So you didn't have much faith in them?
No, and I think everyone accepted this, you know. I mean, one good case, though, where they were coming back. This, we had night after night out on... manning the guns, a lot of it would be with fire at them coming over, hadn't it deterred them in any way. They'd gone up countries like Birmingham, Sunderland, and we'd be stood down there waiting for them to come back. So the South Coast probably was the worst place to be for loss of sleep. It was night after night of this. And most of it was barrage work, as I say, except when Pompey itself got it. But one night, they'd come back, about a dozen of them, and they'd come below the cloud base, and they were perfectly silhouetted, so that the predictor and the Eyefinder crews could actually lay on them with their instruments, and we had a wonderful shoot at them. Didn't bring any down.
What do you remember about the actual Portsmouth Blitz itself and the damage done to the city?
The big thing, most of us were Portsmouth men. So to see Portsmouth where we knew it was, just this one glow, obviously we were most concerned for our own family.
Where were your family living? Which street?
Well, they were living in Portsmouth.
What street were they living
on? Stamchill Road, the north end part of Portsmouth. But the next morning they did allow certain men, as much as they could, to go over and visit Rain to see if the families were all right, like, you know. Then, of course, quite a few of them were these London blokes. So they'd have gone through worse than us, knowing just that London had been bombed, and only hearing it over the radio. Whereas we could see what was going on, you know. And immediately, that following morning, blokes come back with reports, and there wasn't one of the chaps who had lost anyone, which was amazing, wasn't it?
Which particular streets and buildings do you remember being hit badly in Portsmouth?
Lake Road. Lake Road. It was almost gutted, the bottom part of Lake Road, Commercial Road, through there. there had been one occasion before, and there's a... since then, I've read a book. There was a mysterious plane that was brought down in Portsmouth, and we happened to know that it was our troop that brought it down, because we were the only troop firing at that time. And it came down just outside the dockyard gates, the Unicorn Gates, and it completely devastated an area of old cottages. I've read a book since that it was a special bombing mission from Germany with a special type of bomb on it, because in the crater they found some webbing straps with some German markings on it. but we always thought it was... they started using the landmines, as they called them, instead of bombs. They floated down by a parachute. And we always... thought that it was, because it was about this time that they started using them, and we thought it was a plane that came down with these landmines on that completely devastated the area. And the next instance that they knew of these landmines, at Laburnum Grove in Portsmouth, quite a long road with laburnum trees in it, and one came down and caught up swinging in the trees this landmine, and HMS Burnham was the bomb naval explosives experts, and they got hold of it and dismantled it.
What was public morale like in Portsmouth during the bombing?
My own family showed no real concern, other than that anyone to stop in it would be an idiot, and their friend was a truck driver, a van driver, and they used to bundle the family in, his family and my parent and young daughter, youngest daughter, and they used to go over the back of the hill, and they treated it more as a jaunt anyway, took bedding. Went into the local pubs over the back of the hill and spent the night there, you know. And from our contacts in the pubs, there was no... We'd get out on evening leave about once a fortnight. You were laid out for the evening. You had to be back at 12 o'clock. And obviously, if you didn't want to cross over to Portsmouth, because we were at Gosport side, we'd spend the evening in Gosport in pub or cinema, and the civilian population weren't down in any way. In fact, I would say that they were a morale booster to us, because none of us would venture inside of an air raid shelter.
Why?
Well, we thought they were marvellous to go in an air raid shelter. We would sooner be outside to see what's coming. And as I say, being on the guns, you were hitting back anyway, and you didn't give it a lot of thought because you were more interested in what you were doing on the gun than what was happening around it.
So you thought it was more dangerous than the air raid shelter?
Oh, boy, I would have said yes. Yeah. because they weren't aiming at us anyway. They were aiming at the dockyard.
Did you ever go into the air raid shelters?
Pardon?
Did you ever go
no,
into...
No, myself, no. No, I nowhere in the world.
Did people hit the German air crews who were carrying it out?
Yes, I suppose the old British expletive, the bastards, you know.
Do you think
we ourselves? There was one glaring example was that I mentioned these landmines, and there was a lull in the shooting, and it was a moonlight night, and the number five on our gun, the number five was on quite a high platform, it'd be about something like 6 foot up from the ground, and looking around he saw this parachute, and he reported it as parachutist to the command post, which was about 50 yards away. And the gun position officer called him over the gun to point out where it was. Everyone's looking, you know, but he sort of kept going. Run over to the command post and gave him an indication where it was. And the troop commander looked through the telescope of the predictor, because they got that on it, and he said, "Parachutists be buggered, it's a landmine, engage it." And we actually did fire a salvo up at this, as he said, landmine. So I suppose that's kind of hatred, you know.
Do you think the populace would have harmed any pilots who bailed out, who were caught?
I think that again depends. If they'd have actually been affected by it, I think they probably would have done, but I couldn't imagine my family. They showed no, and including their friends. I think, well, no, my father and his friend, who was an ex-Marine, they would have tackled one. They would have tackled him, that's for sure, they would.
What about Churchill? How was he regarded by people in Portsmouth at that time?
I can't, again, speak for the civilian population, because I'd only spoke to my father about him, and the average World War One veteran didn't have a lot of time for Churchill anyway.
Why was that?
Possibly, rightly or wrongly, the Dardanelles, Gallipoli, Churchill, as I say, possibly wrongly or rightly, either is regarded as responsible for that. whereas in latter years you've read more about it. And because really and truly there was only a short gap between World War One and World War Two, whereby the publications were coming out about the actual events. Myself, having read since then about Gallipoli, I would never have blamed Churchill so much for it as the system. But as far as we ourselves, the troops, I certainly heard no adulation of Churchill, and well remember sitting round in the hut listening to this speech. We'll fight them on the beaches, and everyone, oh, the silly old bastard, he hasn't got to do the fighting, you know. And treated it more as a joke. So,
was there any sense that the Germans might win at this time?
Never. I never heard any talk that they would win myself amongst my mates. No. Certainly in the pub, I never heard it, no. No. I don't think it came into it.
So you didn't get people who wanted to give in or come to an agreement?
Oh, no. No, I've never heard anyone. No, no way, and certainly not of mates, you know. They, even, I say, the London boys, I think they would have suffered more with their families, and they coming back on leave. I've never heard them talk that their morale or their families was down, or talk about quitting, that we're going to lose or anything like that, no. But the same token, there wasn't much talk about winning, you know. It's just a case of going on with it.
How do you think the emergency services performed during the Blitz?
Wonderful, wonderful. I think terrific. In fact, one of the things that the through the later service with the Australian forces, their equivalent to our British Legion, is the Return Servicemen's League, which I declined to join because I didn't agree with their only men who'd served overseas could join it. And I didn't go along with that. And I used to say to Australian chaps, there are blokes in British ARP and fire services who contributed towards us winning the war just as much as I did, and probably went through a lot more than I did.
Now, any other incidents that happened to you whilst you were on Gilkicker Point?
Yes, I volunteered for EDMs, this is Defence of Merchant Vessels, and six of us volunteered for this. We were accepted and whipped away by a truck down to a gun site at Netley, this the old military hospital, which was a 3-7 gun site. with the obvious expectation that from there we were going to go to Southampton, which is only a matter of 3 or 4 miles away, and pick up these boats. That night, we were raced out of our huts by a sergeant because the alarm had gone. They were bombing Southampton. So he was ordering us six down into an air raid shelter. And as I said before, no way would they get us into an air raid shelter. So we went down under the... They were 3-7 guns, actually, static 3-7 guns. We went down and spent the night down there with them, blazing away, you know. And next morning, we were returned to our unit at Gilkicker.
So you never became a Dem?
Never become a Dem. Two of them did. Two got some strange reason. This is the queer thing that happened in the war. Strange things would happen. Two did. Two were retained. Two Welsh boys. And another instance, they started a relief system whereby you have four guns, so you're broke up into sections, A and B section. Two guns in A and two in B. And we'd lost so much sleep that we really were walking around like zombies. And they started this relief section. On our site, BHQ was also stationed with this Major Waddington as our battery commander. again, strange why that B section should go for their rest camp first for a fortnight. And they went up onto a gun site, again, a gun site, for a rest on Portsdown Hill. And they brought in a section to relieve them on their two guns. And whereas we were firing something like, the normal thing would be 200 rounds a night, each gun. And because these guns, if it's, you don't want the technical side of it, tell me to shut up, you know. With these four or five guns, with a full charge, they could, the expected life of the barrel was 500 rounds. That's all it can fire, 500 rounds. Well, obviously, after three nights of firing, they'd reach this 500 limit. so, then they'd let you fire five rounds, and then they'd measure the chamber. The gun fitter would be there, and he'd measure the wear of the barrel, and possibly allow you to fire another 10, and so on. And as I say, we're firing like some, in each engagement, you'd fire about 20 rounds. After which, the telecom would ask, number one, gun A, any rounds fired? Number two, gun A, any rounds fired? And we were given something like 30, 28. Number three gun, how many rounds fired? One. This is this relieving section, who obviously weren't as experienced as we were. And this went on for the whole fortnight. And then we went up to this Southwark for our rest. And unusual that we could all, one detachment, get out together, you know. So obviously the first night we were up there, we were all out, the whole detachment, down into Fareham, visiting the pubs and that. Needless to say, Fareham got bombed. Now we go back to the site. The next morning, we're whipped back to Kilker. That was our rest finish, because Major Waddington had gone back from the end of their rest, and the first night back, the guns weren't firing, and he went down to find out what was up, and he realised that these two sections weren't really up to it, and whipped us back, and so we didn't get a rest for some time afterwards, when the section was again relieved, and we went to Seaton in Devon, which is now Warner's Holiday Camp, it's still there, and had a fortnight down there.
But then you went to Tangmere?
Yes.
In July 41?
Yeah, 41. during the day, the guns were kept, and we lived in huts in Lord Cobham house. The guns were under camouflage. Then at night, this was summertime anyway, they used to trundle two of these guns up onto Tangmere Aerodrome as defence of the landing strip. Again, we couldn't see rhyme or reason of this because we had no instruments, just the two guns were taken up there. That were, if we had engaged, it would have been by the method of what we call gun control. The number one of the gun just points the gun in a direction and fires it. they were 3-inch gun.
But by this time it must have been much quieter.
Oh, things, we never actually fired there. It was. The blitzes were finished and we're now working up to go mobile, actually, from static guns to mobile guns. And shortly after that, we went to gunsight near Woking, where there were actual 3.7 mobile guns. And this is where the old regiment was now preparing to go mobile, with a view, I suppose, to going overseas, which is obviously what happened. In fact, as it turned out, that would have been the last action that we saw in England. And we we found this a very attractive period whereby we were moving around from Woking. We actually went down to two of the guns went down to Okehampton in Devon, which used to be an old field artillery range pre-war, and we carried out trials with an anti-tank sight, telescopic sight, on these 3.7 guns. We're down there for about 2 weeks. Came back to Woking, and from then we went to Bushy, Hertfordshire, the town of Bushy. I was billeted in houses, had guns up on the golf course nearby as the gun park, and really started our mobile training. From there we moved down to Blandford Camp, where the whole regiment was taking part on manoeuvres, deploying down in the New Forest quite a lot. Mainly for, I should imagine, for the admin side, the regimental HQ deploying and that, because to us it meant it was just, to us it was just taking a gun to one spot to another and putting it in. There was no actual training from our point of view.
We're talking about the early part of 42 now.
42, yes, this is right, yeah. Blandford, yeah, January 42. That's where I met my wife.
How was it that you actually went abroad in the summer of 42?
Yes. This period from Blandford, the beginning of 42, having carried out this training, they then, there'd be the question of having the equipment, the convoys, necessary ships to get you aboard. So in the meantime, we went to Birmingham, which was a static 3.7 site, and we had experience of all these different guns, so they could put us on any site. And also, in between, despite all the action that we've seen, we went to practice camps down at Aberporth, mainly in Cardiganshire, where we'd go for a fortnight and we'd fire at towed targets. On the surface, it might seem a waste, but, as I say, most of the action was night blitzes, whereby the instruments, the predictor and the height finder, couldn't get onto the target, whereas we're now doing visual shoots, whereby, you know, you could really engage the target. We also went to Neath. That was a 3.7 site. From Neath, we went to Carburton, which was a staging camp for units going overseas.
During all this training you were doing in the United Kingdom in 41-42,